In 1993, 16-year-old Sequoia Vargas hitchhikes with a friend to her friend's home. Later that evening, the man who gave them a ride asks her to go to his cousin's house to watch movies. She never returns home. Despite this being out of character for her, the police brush aside her mom's plea to search for her daughter, sending her family and friends on their own quest to find out what happened to Sequoia that night. This is part one of her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Tonanzin Carmelo.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
So, Vanessa, since we often deal with missing and unidentified cases that involve force and violence, I don't always provide content warnings since it's pretty clear that we talk about some horrific stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I did add a content warning onto our episode of the victims of the Cleveland Torso murders.
Oh, gosh. Are we doing that again?
We're not.
Not the torso murders, but a particularly troublesome.
Yeah, so this is one of the most violent stories that we've shared, and there's really not an adequate way to convey what happened to the victim, which is 16-year-old Sequoia Vargas, without including and detailing some of that information here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't have a heads up.
I did not give you a heads up, no.
Okay.
No.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm good.
Yeah, so Sequoia has been missing since 1993, and this is a case where we know a lot about what happened to her, even though she has never been found. And a lot of that information about what happened to her is included in our podcast.
Okay, so she's still missing, but they do have a lot of information.
Yes.
Which is unusual, kind of.
Well, yeah. I mean, an example would be like the episode we did on Girlie Chew, where they know what happened to her. They know she's been murdered.
That's true.
This is going to actually be a two-parter. I've really tried to keep our episodes like one story, one episode. But to do her story justice, it really does have to be two. This first episode is not the graphic one. It is the second episode that will be. So just forewarning people if they're getting into this story. And before we start, I want to say that Sequoia's half-sister, Dove Johnson, wrote and self-published a book titled Where's Sequoia? That's available on Kindle. This is, as she says, her way of processing some of her feelings about what happened to her sister and her family in the aftermath of her sister's disappearance. I do use her book as one of the sources for this episode, but this book is her truth-telling, so a lot of the emotional weight she writes about, I'm not including here, because I don't want to co-opt that for our episode. I do encourage you to support Dove Johnson by purchasing her book, and we'll include that information in our show notes.
These girls have such beautiful names, too.
Yeah.
Sequoia and Dove.
It's just
so pretty.
There are our two brothers whose names I won't include here since they were minor children when this happened. I mean, they're adults now, but also incredibly beautiful names. Like, their mom was on it with naming her kids. Sequoia Vargas was born on October 29th, 1975 in Oceanside, California, to Rebecca Meza and Esteban Vargas. She's the second of four children. Her sister, Dove, is the oldest. Dove is her half-sister. Dove was 6 years old when Sequoia was born, and she said, "I held her in my arms when she was born."
Mm-hmm.
And after Sequoia, there are two brothers, again, and they're pretty close in age to Sequoia. And the family spent much of her early childhood in Fallbrook, California, near San Diego. Sequoia was Hispanic and Rarámuri, or Tarahumara Indian, which is an indigenous group that inhabited Chihuahua, Mexico. Her older family members spoke mostly Spanish at home, which the children understood but didn't necessarily speak. All except Sequoia. Instead, she invented an entirely new language that used to speak with her siblings. Though the siblings understood her, the adults did not.
That's incredibly cute.
Yeah. But this did lead to a bunch of early interventions for Sequoia because she was not communicating in English or Spanish with her family members. By the time she was 4, her mom was doing intensive language sessions with her, and they even had a special education teacher coming into the house weekly until she was 7. When she entered school, she would invent her own rules for board games. Dove said, put a game in front of her and she'd tell you how to play it.
She's just coming up with everything on her own.
Yeah. She's like very inventive, both in her childhood and later. But because of her lack of language skills, I mean, she had language skills, they were just not. Mm-hmm. And her lack of adherence to rules, she was given various assessments. One of those was an intelligence test, which she performed well on. And one, according to Dove's book, was for autism, and she was given a diagnosis for this. And Sequoia seems like a deeply sensitive and creative individual. You can see that in the way she's kind of moving about her world, right?
Mm-hmm.
She was a vegetarian starting at age 2, and she loved all animals, particularly cats. She even collected porcelain cat figurines as she got older. In Dove's book, she talks about how Sequoia would come home covered in ladybugs and that she'd trap spiders in her hands and then chase boys around with them. Later, her high school friend described her as unique, and that seems to have been true for her entire life. When Sequoia was 6, her parents split, and her mom, Becky, starts calling herself a single mom, so my guess is that she did a lot of the childcare. And in 1989, Becky had a friend who convinced her to move her family to Hawaii, specifically the Big Island's Puna district, because the friend said it was a great place to raise a family. And so when Sequoia was 13, the family moved to Kalapana. Now, one thing to know about this part of Hawaii is that it was, and maybe still is, sometimes described as the wild, wild west of the islands.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like my conceptualization of Hawaii is really informed by like resort life, right?
Right, like movies, what we see of it. Yeah.
The area of Puna itself is bigger than the whole island of Oahu, so it's a big area. Police officers would often be putting in over 100 miles during their shift, and sometimes backup could be 45 minutes away. Electricity would go in and out. So yeah, so it's not necessarily, we've been framed into this world by movies, you're right.
Yeah.
But what attracts people to this area is often the cheap land, and that's still the case today. That's why it drew a lot of hippies in the 1960s and 70s, and it became kind of the center for marijuana trade at the time. There's a mix of retirees and families coming from the mainland, along with some descendants of the earliest Hawaiian settlers, along with descendants of sugarcane workers. There's also ginger, orchid, anthurium, and papaya farmers. It's described as an economically and socially stressed area, but despite this, it seemed like the family looked at this place as paradise.
I think with our snowstorm brewing outside now in April, I'm kind of seeing it as paradise too.
Right. Like anywhere but here.
Anywhere but here.
Sequoia is in middle school when they move there. She was enrolled in Pahoa, an intermediate school, and she was there. She competed against high school students in an island-wide chess competition and won.
This girl seems fun.
She really does. In 1990, most of the town of Kalapana was destroyed by lava flow. Lava has continued to flow in this area over the years, and in fact, the family's first home is no longer there. Her family moved to Leilani Estates and then to the Black Sand Subdivision. In 1991, her mom had open heart surgery. By that point, it seems Dove had maybe moved out and was starting her own family, which left Sequoia to hold down things at the house while her mom was at the hospital, and even when she came home and needed care. During this time, mother and daughter became particularly close. By the next year, 1992, Sequoia was a freshman in high school, and it does seem like she struggled a bit. There were highlights like starring as Gobbs in the Pahoa High School Drama Club's production of The Merchant of Venice, which a friend would later say she was excited about. And she got good grades. She was on the honor roll, but her teacher said she would do better, except that she missed too many classes. This is something that Dove laughs about, saying that Sequoia was probably at the beach. But it's also true that she was picked up for truancy by police. Around this time, she's also doing some fairly typical high school student things. She gets a boyfriend named Joshua Curry, who's a little bit older, and she does things like smoking pot and drinking and partying with some friends at the beach. And it's these behaviors that her family worries cast her as a bad kid to police later when she goes missing. But in the summer of 1993, it sounds like she may have broken up with Joshua, and she decides that she's going to become more focused on her dreams. She writes in her diary about being excited to go back to school. She wanted to work on getting her grades up and making strides towards her dream of going to art college. She loved drawing, and she did everything from fantasy art to comic strips. She was also teaching herself how to play guitar. So an art college would have been the perfect destination for her after high school. Her mother's boyfriend would later say, "She was such a good artist and musician. We told her to use her talent as a tool to express how she felt. She had a deep love for nature and people's lives." In mid-August, she took the SAT and was the only member of her school there taking it. Her next step was to start working on her portfolio for college, and this was something that she looked forward to. On August 21st, 1993, her friends say that a group of about 20 of them, including Sequoia, gathered together to camp overnight at Kahana, which is a black sand beach that's quite popular in the area. This gathering isn't necessarily surprising since school was starting the next week. It sounds like a typical beach party. Sequoia's best friends, twins named Angelique and Monique, were there, and at some point Sequoia's ex, Joshua Curry, shows up and they talk about the possibility of getting back together.
Okay. And how old is Sequoia at this point? Is she's 16? 16.
Okay. Yeah. Her boyfriend is like a little bit older. Not too much, but... Or ex at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, August 22nd, Sequoia and her friend, 17-year-old Jessica, were hitchhiking. I've seen two different reports. One is that they were hitchhiking from the beach on what is known as the Red Road. The Red Road is actually the Kalapana-Kapoho Road running between the two towns, and it got its name from the red asphalt that was used to pave it originally. And another is that they were on this same Red Road but had stopped briefly at Sequoia's house first before heading to Jessica's. It's really a minor difference, but one I thought I should mention here. It's pretty common for people to hitchhike along this road, particularly true for teenagers in the 1990s. Becky, Sequoia's mom, said all the girls knew the rules of hitchhiking, like never going alone and calling when they reached their destination. So when a man pulls over and offers a ride, they agree. They want a ride to Jessica's house. Jessica lived in an area called Nanavale Estates, which is a small community in the Pune area. After he drops them off, the man asks for Jessica's phone number. He says that he'll call them later to see if they want to come over to his cousin's house and watch television. When they get inside and share this with Jessica's mom, Gail is like, "No way, you can stay home and watch TV."
Good for Gail.
Yeah, Gail was like, not happening.
Yeah, exactly.
And so when the man calls back, Sequoia tells him that Jessica can't go, but that she can. He stops by shortly later, and that's the last time Jessica saw her friend. This moment will haunt Jessica's mom, Gail, for the rest of her life. Later, after the world learns what happens to Sequoia once she left that house, Gail will say, "I think every day, is it my fault? Is it partly my fault that this happened?"
I think it's natural to feel that way, but at the same time, like, you can tell your kids what to do, but you can't, you can, like, guide your kids' friends, but you can't tell them what to do.
Right. And, you know, so she made this rule for Jessica, and it's only in retrospect that, you know what happened.
Right.
Like, you can't know the repercussions.
99.9% of the time, this isn't the way the story goes.
Yeah. And on that August 8th, Gail, she can't know what's going to happen. And at that moment, it's really just teenagers trying to fill in their last days of summer.
Right. I'd hate for her to feel that way. But I mean, I would, wouldn't you?
I would. Yeah.
I definitely would.
But the next day, Sequoia's mom, Becky, is sitting at home and worried about Sequoia. To Becky's understanding, Sequoia was supposed to have spent the night at Jessica's. Becky and Sequoia had talked about going clothes shopping maybe the next day for back-to-school clothes, but there's a major problem and Sequoia hadn't come home. Now, largely, Becky had put a lot of trust in her daughter. They had a good relationship, and Sequoia always checked in with her mom when she wasn't going to be home. And Becky had told her that the rule was that if she hadn't heard from her in 24 hours, she would absolutely call the police. And that seems like a parenting threat, like the thing that you say to get your kid to, like, call you. But Sequoia had abided by it before this point. So when Becky hasn't heard from Sequoia and hasn't been able to reach her, she does contact police. And like we often hear, they brushed her off. Mm. They said Sequoia was probably just a runaway and that she'd be back.
This is the kind of thing, you know, this is the kind of thing that bothers me most about these stories. How can we say that she's just a runaway and she'll probably be back when there's that whole thing with like the guy that she was going to go watch TV with and like she has this close relationship with her mom and even if she was a runaway, let's still look for her because she's probably still in danger.
Yeah, from my understanding, it seems like police don't even get to the point where they're like, guys she was going to go watch TV with. They're just like, brush her off immediately. That's why her family worries that like she'd been contextualized as like a bad kid.
Right. But so what if she is? Maybe we should also be looking for bad kids.
We should be looking for all kids.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just, this is like what's continually frustrating. Like, why isn't a runaway kid a kid that you're worried about and looking for?
They all need to be found, whether they're runaway or not runaway, bad or not bad. Like,
yeah,
let's just find the kid.
We'll be back in a moment. So to provide some context, in that October of that year, so a few months later, there are 83 missing or runaway children on the island.
Do we know the population of this island?
Well, you know, it's like the Big Island of Hawaii. So I don't know the population of it in 1990, but that's a significant amount.
That seems high because those are all children. Like, yeah. Those are all under 18, right? So. Yeah.
So there's like a newspaper article that's run because they think that the problem is greater due to underreporting, right?
Okay.
And that the problems seem to be worsening. Those in the social services field were seeing younger and younger kids running away. And Pauline Pavo, who at the time was the director of Hilo's interim house, said at the time they were seeing predictable increases at certain times of the year, one of those being when school started up. So when Sequoia went missing, school is about to begin. And so it just gets sort of shoved aside as like, kids.
Too many of them running away now.
Yeah. So when police brush aside her parents, it's not necessarily surprising to me, particularly because we've talked about this quite a bit, about how runaway teenagers are treated. Later, police captain Raymond Samoa would defend this by saying, "We had no information at first to indicate that there was foul play. We did learn from the parents that it was unusual for Sequoia not to notify them."
So he knew this and still didn't.
Yeah, because her mom, her family members are very much emphasizing, like, look, this is outside the norm. And to them, they know she's not a runaway. This is extremely outside of their regular behavior. It's just that they can't get police to take it seriously.
Imagine being in that position. Like, let's take parents seriously.
Yes. They know their children. Or they should. Instead, the family is told by police to try to get the community involved in searching for her. So like countless other families we've talked about, this leaves the Vargas family to do the search for her without police support. This isn't in the papers, but Dove does talk about in her book, and she says that her mom calls together a family meeting and they start planning their search for Sequoia. One of the places they start with is, of course, Jessica. Now, we don't use perpetrator names, so I'm just using initials. Hopefully this doesn't get too confusing. But Jessica says a man named D picked them up while they were hitchhiking. She says he claimed to be a professional skateboarder. This could have been to impress Sequoia because she had her skateboard with her. Jessica thought he lived somewhere in her neighborhood.
So D is definitely the perpetrator here in the story. Oh, clearly.
Clearly.
Clearly. Okay.
Okay. Jessica had trouble remembering the vehicle they'd been in. But the family asked if she would consider being hypnotized to see if that would help her call up details. While under hypnosis, she recalled it was a red or maroon Subaru. This is such a major clue, so some of the family start looking for this car. They're also plastering everywhere with flyers about Sequoia and searching along roads looking for her. At one point, a psychic also contacts them and claims Sequoia's alive and being held in a shack. So the family goes on a frantic search, even trespassing, looking for a location that matches this. And the psychic keeps kind of like hooking them. Basically, every time the family speaks with her, she sounds more and more upset, saying that they're running out of time. So the family's intensifying their search. They're basically pulling out all stops in order to find her.
Okay, so the whole family is doing like this big search. They even have like the psychic involved.
Right.
So while this is all happening, what's happening with the police?
So though Sequoia was last seen at the end of August, the first newspaper articles published about her don't happen until September 2nd. And it's just a brief mention of her disappearance, along with a local teen's disappearance. The police say they have not classified this case, so it's clear at this point it is not considered a missing persons case. There's some indication that they're looking for a blue or gray car, possibly a Toyota. This is one of the early details that I think kind of stalls out the investigation, at least on their part. And Dove will later say that some girls had come forward to say that they'd seen Sequoia at the mall. And Dove said that if police had spoken to anyone in the family, they'd have let the police know that this wasn't likely because Sequoia hated the mall. So the police are still not taking this seriously because they believe that she was seen at the mall after the date of her disappearance and therefore must be a runaway.
Okay, what is the correlation between being seen at the mall and being a runaway?
People have seen her. She's fine. She's out shopping. Like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which again, if they had just spoken to the family, like...
Right, she wasn't... She hates malls.
She like, wouldn't be her.
Yeah.
So that leaves the family to continue their own searches. Dove and her aunt even sit in a parking lot looking for a car that matches what Jessica said. They see one pass by and they follow him to the Pahoa Cash and Carry store. When he leaves, they get his information from the cashier. His name is Jay and he's from Maui, but staying in Nana Valley with his fiancée and her three children. So they send Sequoia's uncle Brad to Jay's house and ask him where Sequoia is. I love that it's like...
It's, like they're very, part. Like, they're getting into, like, this investigation in, like, a really great way. Like, there's so many people participating in this.
Right. So, like, everyone's on board. Except the police.
Except for the police. Yeah. I mean, that detail, right?
Right. And so Brad is there questioning him because, like, this is the only car that they've seen that matches this description. You know, they've done this kind of... search and finding him. Brad says that when he is talking to Jay, Jay is shaking when they talk.
So he's nervous.
Yes. What Jay ends up telling him is that, yeah, Sequoia was at his house that night, but he says that she left with his cousin, D.
Okay.
When Brad asks, hey, where is this D guy? All he got back was that Dee had gone to Santa Cruz, California, which is where he lived with his girlfriend.
So Jay and his fiance and is it her three kids?
Yes.
Are all living in this house?
Right.
That they say Dee brought her back to?
Right.
Huh.
Yeah.
What about the like fiance and the kids? Are they... Have they said anything?
So the thing about the fiance and her children is they're off island in Maui from August 21st to August 24th. So during the time that Sequoia would have been there. So even though she's back and at the house when Brad is questioning them, she actually doesn't share much information.
So she wasn't there when Sequoia was at the house.
Right.
So it's just basically what Jay and has to say about it at this point, and this D guy.
Exactly.
Okay.
So this is the family's lead. They've discovered that Sequoia was indeed there that night, and Jay has, like, confirmed this, right? A family friend is able to tell them that D has an ex on the island and has an infant daughter with her, and they lived nearby. So Dove and her mom, they're going to go see what this ex-girlfriend knows.
Okay. Do we know how old Dee is?
He is in his early 20s at this point.
Okay.
Like, not someone who should have been around.
Trying to watch TV with a 16-year-old?
Exactly.
Yeah.
In the first place. So when they go and talk to this ex-girlfriend and the mom of his child, she confirms that on that night that Sequoia disappeared, Dee had come to her house at around midnight and that his clothing was wet.
Okay.
She said that Dee Jay, remember their cousins.
Yep.
And Jay's mom, Maureen, and a man we're going to call M, all came over because the brown van that Jay and Dee were using was broken down and needed to be jumped.
Okay, so there's like a lot of people.
There's a whole cast of people here.
Were M and Maureen ever questioned in this? Are we going to get to that?
We are going to get to that. So
this episode or...
Well, Maureen will come later. She's okay. Her own complicated person.
She's got her own story.
She definitely has her own story. But at this point, what they've gathered is more information that there's, you know, Jay and Dee who have intersected with Sequoia.
Mm-hmm.
They also know at that night that Maureen was there and M was there as well at this ex-girlfriend's house. So they've got more people basically that they can go and question.
Right. And then there's these weird things like the broken down car and the wet clothing.
Yeah. So now we've got like these pieces that don't currently fit in the story.
They'll make sense later.
Make sense later. So this is like their first introduction to these little bits of evidence. Mm-hmm. Dove is also able to get Dee's phone number and she calls him. Now he's in California at this point and she asks him what he knows about Sequoia. He says he picked Sequoia and Jessica up and then he went back to Jessica's house and picked up Sequoia. He says that he and Sequoia smoked some weed and drank some beer with some friends in Pahoa. Later, they went back to Jay's house where they watched TV. And then Dee wanted to go see his ex and daughter. When they were headed that way, there was an oncoming truck. And Dee said Sequoia asked to get out because it was some of her friends. He says this is the last time he saw her, which was around 10 p.m. that night.
Okay, so it's dark out. They're driving down the road. She's able to look into another vehicle, see that it's her friends, stop in time for them to notice and stop too.
Yes.
And then get out and get in the car.
Uh-huh.
When have you ever been able to do that at night?
Exactly.
Nobody right. can.
Nobody can. And so, you know, this is her...
His out on like, oh, I haven't seen her past 10?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
I picked up a 16-year-old. I'm an adult. We smoked weed together and drank together, and then I let her safely out with her friends.
Right. So Dove says that when she hung up the phone, like, she knew that he was lying.
Obviously.
Not long after this interaction with Dee, Dove says that they were at Becky's house and talking, and she says that M, the third man that was mentioned, came to the house with his dad.
Okay.
Becky went outside to talk to them. She noticed that M had his hand wrapped up in a bandage. When she asked him about it, he said he got cut in a fight. But when she asked him about Sequoia, he said he didn't know anything about it.
So he's the only guy who doesn't know anything about her.
Yeah, so he's like, saying, I don't know anything.
Like D and J do, but M knows nothing.
Right.
And how is M fit into it? Is he another cousin or a friend? Or
so he's a friend of D and J.
Okay. And are they all in their 20s?
M is in his late teens.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, as far as the family knows so far, M has really come up in the conversation because he was at D's ex-girlfriend's house that night.
So okay.
They're asking him if he knows anything, but he might not, right?
Right. He might not.
Yeah.
He's the one who came in with Maureen and, like, helped with the car.
Yeah, but then Becky's out there and she's seeing, like, he's got a bandage wrapped around his hand. She's like, this is suspicious, I think, right?
Right.
What happens next is that a few hours later, M, again, he's 19 at this time, he walks into the Hilo police station and he gives a statement. And that, what he says that night, changes everything.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, The Origin of Language, read by Tonanzin Carmelo. Tonanzin is an award-winning actress, voice artist, and choreographer playing lead and supporting roles for film, television, video games, theater, and more. Her credits include a series regular as Para on NBC's La Brea, touching ground in the BBC miniseries The English, Kendra Daniels in the original video game Dead Space, and Shayla Stonefeather in the independent film Imprint. In addition, she has guest starred on a number of TV shows, including The Rookie, Animal Kingdom, Undone, American Dad, and Spirit Rangers.
The Origin of Language, Sequoia Vargas, 16, missing since August 22, 1993, from Hilo, Hawaii. The fall into Pele's arms is not gentle, nor is the half-struck dark and passage of headlights over skin. An ironwood tree rustles. Alone, it could be mistaken for the ocean. She wants to bridge her body close to the fractured bark, hold back the sea cliff and stare of moonlight. She does not know how one thing leads to the next, how the wet rot of vegetation on the shore road becomes heady rye of alcohol, how her body leaves soil for air and water. But like all things, it can be reduced to a beginning. Not the moment she opened the door or slid a chess piece across a board. It begins in the place they do, in the murk, where three boys began to take breath. She once believed a conch shell held to the ear sounds like the ocean. When they said it was a reflection of pulse, a trickery of the inner ear, she believed they didn't speak the language. But here is where she learns. This bead of light and salt sounds nothing like the inside of a shell.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.